Latter-day Saint Home Educators is pleased to bring you this audio presentation, recorded live during the May 2022 Home Education Conference held in Morristown, Tennessee.
Hi, so I'm Ian Cox, and my talk today is how the Old Testament made me an optimist, from doom and gloom to looking forward with hope. So I don't know how familiar you guys are with the Old Testament. Probably a lot of you guys are studying it this year, right? But the first time I went through it, it wasn't the most exciting. For one, it's not really a grabber, right? An interest grabber. And two, it didn't really seem that positive to me the first time going through it. So I love the title of this talk. The Old Testament versus the New Testament. Let's start with that. I'm just going to give a little bit of an introduction. So the Old Testament, first thing I realized as I was going through it, as reading it at a Freedom Classic, is that the Old Testament is more of a history, whereas the New Testament is more of a standard of living. The Old Testament is more of a show, being a history. It's showing you these big brush strokes very quickly sometimes. You go through a few verses and all of a sudden you've traversed hundreds of years sometimes. The New Testament is more precepts. It's more telling you how to live or the good principles to find, right? So that was one of the big things that started me down this path of recognizing the Old Testament as a classic, and especially as a Freedom Classic, as commentary on current events. That shifted so much for me, and that originally came from reading Locke, his second treatise on government, because he was making a case for a societal structure based on some scriptures in the Old Testament, and he was giving his commentary on current events when he was living and writing, talking about the progression of history in his time and talking about how we should found our society, building it off of families like it talks about in the Old Testament, following the ancient Israelites and the Saxons. So that it started bringing up a lot of interesting questions for me. And it's fun because you get into some of these older political commentators like Locke, Hume, Bastiat, there's a good list of them, Polybius, and they reference these old writings like the Old Testament, and they pull out some really cool principles, some really cool ideas. So you get into Genesis, right? And he talks about three lights during the creation, right? You guys all know what I'm talking about? The beginning, created sun, the moon, the stars. So these political commentators like Locke read this and said, if there are three governing bodies of light, then I think our society should have three branches of government. And then they keep reading. I'm just going to skim over this. I'm going to give you a quick list. Write this down. So you run into the three lights, and they say our government should have three branches of government. For me, that was a big aha moment. That was a big jump. I would never have gotten there. I would never have read Genesis and said, oh, they're talking about structures of government. Obviously. For me, that was way over my head. So when Locke was talking about these things, it kind of blew my mind a little bit how they were seeing and understanding their scripture. Genesis 1, going through pretty much all of Genesis 1, hits on the three branches of government. Write that down. Go back and reread that, looking for balances of power. Then you get in Genesis 1 overlapped with Deuteronomy 30. Deuteronomy 30 really hits on the separations of powers. Deuteronomy 30 also hits on the checks on the courts. The sun represented the executive branch, the executive power. The moon represented the judicial. And the stars, the many, is the legislative branch. The sun is the executive, the moon is the judicial, and the stars is the legislative. So it was kind of a fun realization for me. That was a different way to see this classic, to read this classic that I've never done before. So let's jump into some stories. So now I was reading differently. I had different questions, and I had some of these other commentators that I'd studied that I'd read before. And they led me to approach this and think about this in a very different way. So first, we're going to start digging into the optimism versus the pessimism, where this started coming for me. So Noah lived in a society of oppression, greed, lasciviousness, right? It wasn't a very good society at the time. The lesson we learn here is about these cycles in history, that a small committed group of individuals are enough to bring about change, to accomplish what's needed. I'm going to jump to Abraham. Again, I'm going to bullet point, talk about a quick lesson, and we're going to look at how this ties into current events in a little bit here. So Abraham grew up in a society of pride, greed, and oppression, coming through another cycle, right? He was led to a new promised land where freedom and abundance could flourish. Still, his own children chose the path of rulers and force, cycling back through yet again. Our lesson here from Abraham is that even with a great leader or king, it only can last so long. Right? Nephi talks about this. He says it's a very limited prosperity when you have kings or aristocracies ruling. You can have some really high highs, some of the best highs, in fact, with a monarchy or aristocracy. But then usually within a generation or two, you get some of the lowest lows that are incredibly oppressive. They can be horrendous systems to live in. So establishing, this is part of the lesson from Abraham that we're getting, establishing self-government is worth it, and it takes time. It takes a lot of effort. The tribes of Israel, actually let's go to Moses first, stay somewhat in chronological order. Moses is a fantastic example. We get a lot of detail on Moses because Moses was the one writing the first 5 books, and he knew a lot about what was going on with him. So, kind of makes sense, right? You get a lot of good history about Moses and that process that God takes us through in setting up a free society. This one I'm going to skim through quite a bit. There's a lot here. So the people, they were enslaved initially, went through the process, the miracles, were freed. Then they wandered in the wilderness for how long? 40 some odd years. Because the people did not comprehend how to govern themselves. And so God was more than willing to wait to guide them through that process until they were able to do that. And then you roll into the tribes of Israel. See, so the tribes of Israel was an interesting one for me because when you read their history, it doesn't really seem prosperous and free. Right? There's always squabbles, they're always fighting, they're always warring, they're always killing each other, fighting somebody else. Like, it seems like there's always some war going on. Always somebody doing something they're not supposed to, and the earth opens up and swallows a couple hundred people. Actually, let's read that. I was just reading that on the flight over a day or two ago, and this is such a perfect example, because this is where I want to start. So Numbers 17, very end of Numbers 17, verse 12 and verse 13 says, "And the children of Israel spake unto Moses, saying," so what just happened? What just happened? There's a lot going on. So the children of Israel said, "We want to be like the Levites. We all want to worship in this way." So they all go and they burn incense and they go to the tabernacle, and they're just crossing over a lot of the boundaries in the priesthood that was set up in the time. So they broke a lot of rules. And then God came, Jehovah came, said, "That was wrong. Opened up the earth and swallowed about a couple hundred people. Some of the other people who then burned incense were trying to escape, and then fire came from the heavens and killed a couple other people. And now this is the people coming to Moses, lamenting." So just think about that for a second. Imagine you're the survivors, and a bunch of these families from this other tribe have just been swallowed up into the earth. And then some other people who broke some other rules have just been burned by fire from heaven. Okay, and you come to the tabernacle, you call to Moses, because you're scared, right? I would be scared. I'm going to be looking around, waiting for the next shoe to drop, and am I the one who's going to catch it? There's a little bit of context for you. So Numbers 17:12. And the children of Israel spake unto Moses, saying, Behold, we die, we perish. We all perish. They're pretty pessimistic right now. Whosoever cometh anything near unto the tabernacle of the Lord shall die. Shall we be consumed by dying? As you're going through getting this history, seeing rules broken, consequences for breaking rules, especially in our lives today, we often feel like that. The struggles, the hardships. Candace's talk before this, I was so glad as she was going, I kept taking more and more notes, that it was just so great living by faith and that hope, that inspiration, that when all those logs she was talking about are on the fire, ready to just explode in flames, that everything was happening this week, and we can't make it work. That's how it frequently feels, especially in the current climate of our world today, right? That's how we frequently feel. Shall we all be consumed by dying, or by these struggles, by these pressures, these demands? Numbers 18, verse 5 and 6. This is God's response. This is God speaking to Moses. When Moses hears the people, says, yeah, that's a good point. So he goes to God, says, here's the plight. Now what do I do? And this is God's response. And ye shall keep the charge of the sanctuary. So he's saying we've established some rules and procedures, and we're going to keep those. We need to keep those. We need to obey those. That's the first lesson here. Stop breaking those rules, please. Keep the charge of the sanctuary and the charge of the altar. For us in modern times, for the LDSHG conference specifically, think of the altar. Think of where we worship at the altar. Think of the charges that we receive today, right here, right now. What are the charges given to us at the altar in the Holy Scriptures or the covenants that we make? Because that charge has not changed. And ye shall keep the charge of the sanctuary, or today our temple, and the charge of the altar, that there be no wrath anymore upon the children of Israel. That's the first bit. That's the first answer. Live the law of sacrifice. Live the law of charity. Verse 6, And I, behold, I have taken your brethren, the Levites, from among the children of Israel. To you they are given as a gift for the Lord to do the service of the tabernacle of the congregation. So you have to recognize what God's doing here. His hand that's at work throughout these stories and in our personal lives. We struggle, we get hit, it hurts. And at every turn, He says, all right, here's the guidelines that you need to follow. And I give you a gift to make it possible, to make it work, and to make it happen. Adam and Eve, we have Noah, we have Abraham, we have Moses, we have Joshua, Gideon, David, Solomon, Daniel, Esther, Job. Once I started seeing that gift, it's incredible. It's incredible what the Lord makes happen throughout all the history of the world. So just talking to the youth over there, one of the things we have to recognize is that even the tyrants through history, see these, I just named off a big list, and it's only a few of them in this grand history. These guys are more the heroes that conquered against all odds. There were always just a few small numbers that overcame, that succeeded, because they had faith. They kept doing the right things. They kept learning and mastering the principles. But even tyrants, you can look up Xerxes, Attila the Hun, but especially, let's take some more modern examples, a Robespierre in France, or a Mao in China. So if we look at our world history and more recent current events, it's interesting to see God's trajectory. So if you'll imagine with me a big graph. Okay, you guys have all seen a graph before, right? I don't need to fish out the whiteboard and draw it out for you. Imagine a big graph. And we're going to zoom all the way out and look at the entire history of the world. And it's really interesting. So if you have, you know, freedom, looking at freedom and abundance, it has a gradual increase. If you zoom all the way in, then it goes like this. It has a lot of times when it drops down, and it comes up, and it comes up, and it drops down, right? And it just keeps cycling like that. But if you look at it in a logarithmic graph, it just continually increases over time. When I started seeing that trend in the Old Testament, and then the Middle Ages, and then modern time, the struggles that we're facing today actually kind of got me excited. Because the struggles we have today can't happen unless we have freedom. They couldn't have the struggles we have today 1,000 years ago. There wasn't enough education. There wasn't enough opportunity. There wasn't enough production. There wasn't enough health for the average person to live long enough. The opportunities, what we have today, are better than ever before in the entire history of the world. It's crazy when you start looking up numbers, like the 1% or the poverty, the poor in first world countries, United States, Canada, lots of countries in Europe, are part of the 1% wealthiest in the world. That's pretty crazy to think about. That our poor here are still part of the 1% wealthiest, and then especially if you compare it to 1,000 years ago, the kings and queens didn't live as well as most of the poor in our country here. Now, I'm not saying that they need to buck up and be happy about it. That's not what I'm saying at all. What I am saying, that look at the opportunity, look at the trajectory that we can give to those that are our neighbors, and the trajectory for the rest of the world. Give us another 100 years, another 1,000 years, and guess what? Where are we going to be? Now I might think he's sneaky, and that he got away with killing and committing genocide, but God recognizes cycles. He knows how to take the evil and the corruption, and out of the ashes, grow something beautiful and fantastic. He can take the people that lived in slavery and only could think slavery and take them through the wilderness so that by the end of it, they can have states. Once you start comparing the United States with the children of Israel, the tribes of Israel, they're almost exactly the same. The history, the squabbling, the fighting, the going back and forth. Guess what? We just got checks and balances. When these powers are competing against each other, that's called checks and balances. It's a Republican form of government. It has layers and separation. They talk about the chieftains and, you know, the chiefs of the hundreds and thousands and tens of thousands, right? But you also have your vertical separations of powers, but then your horizontal are just as important. The children of Israel, all the struggling things that were going on are exactly the same as what we have today. Exactly the same, air quotes there, because that's not exactly the same. Don't war against each other as much as they did, I think, when you're comparing exact parallel histories. But when you start seeing that our time isn't quite so different as their time, for one, it's like, oh, well, darn. Grass isn't greener on the other side. And I guess maybe it's not as great today as I thought maybe it was. But on the flip side of that, instead of taking the pessimistic approach of that, I got really excited, saying, oh, the ancient Israelites was actually a period of freedom, a golden age of freedom and prosperity. What they were able to accomplish, the progress that they were able to accomplish, the support and health of the masses in that time was better than almost anywhere else in the world. And we see that a Gideon, even though he was called, recall Gideon's story, he was asked to reduce his army again and again and again to go fight this nation that's powerful, huge, until he has just a tiny little group of faithful. See, God does this every single time. I hope you recognize this. That's Gideon's story. That's Joshua and Caleb's story. That's Daniel's story. That's Esther's story. That's Job's story. God keeps taking these tiny little groups, and then he finds out any way he can to get a smaller group says, all right, now go do it. Now you're ready to recognize that I am in charge, not you. It doesn't matter if there's giants. It doesn't matter if it's hard. It doesn't matter if you disagree and you're not really sure how to lead. You'll figure it out. Go do it. That's what I'm asking you to do. And if I ask you to do it, it will happen. He has foreordained freedom to happen. It is going to happen whether you're a pessimist or not. Now, if you're going to be like Jonah and go the pessimist route, which is a great story for us to learn from, because what does he do? He tries to run and hide, and God takes him to where he needs him anyways, right? And he goes and preaches to the people of Nineveh, and then what do? They repent, they change. Even a pessimist can win. We can't lose. Now, that doesn't happen in every case in history. The French Revolution lasted over 80 years. The Maoist Revolution happened over several decades, where mass murdered millions of people. But even today, China has more freedom and opportunity than they did before. Even with tyrants and evil oppressors trying to break the cycle, trying to bring back more control and force governments and economies, they can't win, because what they always do is break the old system, which was bad, and provide an opportunity for the new system of actual freedom to step in. Again, sometimes it takes a really long time. China's not there yet. I don't think they're even close to ideal. Russia's not there yet. I don't think it's anywhere close to the ideal. France got there, way closer to the ideal. We got there, 1700s, 1800s. We still have a significant amount of freedom. So even if you choose not to follow those rules, God says, okay, I can work with that. You can work through struggle and pain and strife and sorrow for another 100 years. I'm okay with that. Me personally, now I'm not speaking as father, I'm not okay with that. That means my kids and my grandkids are going to be oppressed. I'm not okay with that. That has to happen now. That has to happen right now. I'm not okay with dishing that off on my kids. Because we still, right now in America, we have the opportunity and the chance to choose into God's freedom. He's happy to let it happen whenever we choose to. Whenever we're ready for it. He's right there giving us blessing after blessing, opportunity after opportunity. For me, the evidence is just so blatantly clear. The Old Testament is packed full of miracle after miracle, of God being patient and waiting, and of consequences of rules, but you're looking at the overarching picture, and He is always there, every step of the way, giving correction, allowing us to choose into our pain and struggles, and then always there to bless, to send manna from heaven, to bring down the walls of Jericho, to let our state squabble and argue and bicker, and to have one of the most free and prosperous eras ever. We don't have to be perfect. We just have to be willing to discuss and have faith in those principles. So we're seeing a pattern here as we dig through the Old Testament. Oh, so many good stories. And I'm pretty sure that the Nineveh story is thrown in there specifically to just show that God's in charge. Even the pessimist can do it. I love that. I think that's so funny. So what are these principles? What is this cycle? Because understanding the cycle, I think, also helps. Having these stories, examples of God's miracles and blessings, His hand in our lives, for me is where I started shifting, becoming an optimist. And actually reading the Freedom Classics was one of the big things that did it for me. It's amazing reading the Freedom Classics, because they are incredibly optimistic fellows who are always writing and living in times of not very much freedom. And they always believed that it was going to win, that it was going to flourish. And I've always been, I started out looking and hoping, all right, where is the ideal? Where is the success? Where is that pinnacle where we finally make it and have this perfect, excellent, free society? And I never found it. You find pockets of freedom like the ancient Israelites, like the Saracens, like the Greek Golden Era, the Roman Republic. The Saxons have times where they had a significant freedom. You know, American Revolution era, we love these times and we love this, and then you dig into the history and it's messy. You look and you zoom into the history and the accounts in those places, and it looks a lot like
the tribes of Israel and our current states. It's just complex and it's messy. You know, Alexis de Tocqueville, before I get into the cycle, the big picture cycles here, Alexis de Tocqueville came to America in the early 1800s, published a work called Democracy in America in 1835. And he said he was really surprised by what he found in the states. Because like we said earlier, in aristocracies and monarchies, you can have the high of the highs. You can have extreme freedom and extreme prosperity. But then after a generation or two, right, you get the lows of the lows. And then it usually stays there for a really long time. He said, I was really surprised, because here's this new fledgling country that's actually working. It's stuck, it's working, they're expanding, they're growing, the culture, the learning. So he was really curious. So he travels over, wanders all over, comes into the homes and goes to the governments in different states and the federal government. He wanders all over and he writes in his book, he says, what I found was that the government, the leadership, the public leadership in America is really mediocre. Which means today we're still doing okay. Honestly, like think about that. If in our golden era, this guy's coming and says the government's just kind of mediocre. They can't get things done. They can't agree. They're not really the high of the highs, low of the low. It's just kind of mediocre. That's what freedom looks like. Honestly, truly, that's what freedom looks like. It's just kind of mediocre. It's a little complex and it's a little messy and can't usually agree very well because you're having a discussion. See, the founders tapped into something really special. How do you prolong freedom and prosperity? How do you check and balance different powers in a society? Your aristocratic powers and the masses, the powers in the people. How do you check and balance these different groups? And so when you check and balance those, that means you get a lot of... And it just doesn't really work very well. And that's what it's supposed to do. It's supposed to be slow and arduous. Especially when you're dealing with power and force. Does that make sense? So that it's surprised, so Tocqueville said it really surprised me that the government is just kind of mediocre. And what did astound me is that at any place, whether it's in the backwoods of Tennessee, quoting, or in the cities, in the north, in the south, wherever I went into the homes, and these people had read Shakespeare, they had read Plutarch, they had read the Constitution, they had their papers, they knew what was happening in their municipality, they knew what was happening in the state, they understood what was happening at the national level, they were discussing this around the dinner table with their little children. The people themselves understood the details of the structure of power and the structure of their government. And they understood human nature and general ideas. They lived it. So that, it was the family. It wasn't this grand king who understood how to orchestrate things right or give enough freedom in the right places to produce this great American project. It wasn't some grand aristocracy who owned everything and controlled everything. It was the family across the board that produced, for one, a mediocre government, and for two, an incredible population who understood what the representatives were doing and understood the positives and negatives of human nature. How to develop character in themselves, how to discern good character in others, and how to hold the line in what they believed, which meant there was sometimes disagreement. And then they would argue, and they would debate, and then people would vote, and then they would do that. That was the genius, was the family unit. And that widespread discussion. All right, so the cycles, that's what I forgot. I knew there was something really important that I forgot. So looking at these cycles, this was another piece that really helped me out of understanding, of shifting, because I was a natural pacifist. My mom was a freedom fighter, education fighter for most of her life, even before she had kids. And she's a hero of mine. And my dad is a hero of mine. However, my mom was and isn't as much anymore. I've almost got her to be a full-blown optimist, so I'm still working on her. But she was a pessimist. She said this was her basic belief, because you get involved in politics and it's messy and it's tricky and it doesn't ever feel like you win, right? It just rarely ever feels like you win. You never get the idea. Again, we're just looking for mediocre. Honestly, truly, we're just looking for mediocre. Just looking for mediocre, I'm not even kidding. If the Republicans owned the world, that would be bad. If the Democrats owned the world, that would be bad. We need a mix of the two. I'm not even joking. We need both of them. And then a few others need to get in there too. Working on that one. We need some other parties and independents. But we're just looking for mediocre, because honestly, truly, that has produced 200 years of the most prosperous and free nation in the history of the world. That is the outcome. That's the story of Joshua and Caleb. That's the story of Moses and the children of Israel. That's the tribes of Israel. And we get blessed when we just try to do our best and love our neighbor and understand that I can disagree with them, we can discuss with them, and they're just trying to do their best. Honestly, I believe over 90% of people are just trying to do their best. There's a few on each category that are really pushing things and driving things that are probably not actually good people and trying to do bad things. Right? That's really such a small number. Your neighbor that you disagree with, and politically you think they're going to destroy us and send us all, they're just doing their best, you guys. Let's argue, let's discuss, let people vote, and let's just be mediocre. Let's accept that. Let's allow them to disagree with us. Because it is amazing when you get libertarians and socialist Democrats, and if you can cut around the edges and let them talk about that common ground, it's amazing how common they are. And it's in part because, oh dear, I'm just going to throw something out and you guys are just going to go with it, okay? Because I don't have time to really dig into it, because this is really fun to dig into. Because that juxtaposition specifically, libertarians and socialism and communism, Karl Marx, being one of the main founders and fathers of modern communism, and Ayn Rand, being one of the mothers of modern libertarianism, are almost exactly the same person. They're almost exactly the same. And I'm getting some scowls from different parties and groups. Go read their philosophy. So there's different, again, their solutions of how they get there are very different, but they're both rooted in humanism. And they both reject that common ground of God. And so Ayn Rand ends up having an elitist group who owns and runs the entire world. And Karl Marx, by the end of communism, what you actually have is an elitist group who just owns the entire world. They're both solutions and in exactly the same place. Now, Ayn Rand has a ton that I absolutely love. And she hits some points that are spot on and powerful, that are very contrary, again, her ideology, but where she ends, she branches off of the Austrian economics. For Austrian economics, I think it's fantastic. Where she ends is an elite group owns everything. That's where she leads it to, and her relationship stuff is really twisted and broken, I think. But she has a lot that's spot on. You read Karl Marx, and he has a ton that's spot on. He diagnoses the problem really well. He understands the need for community really well. But then he abolishes private property and gives all the power to the state, and now you just have another elite group owning the whole world. And we just have aristocracy. So it's a little bit of both. Not all of both. At least in my mind, through my study, that's and digging into the history of the world, we can't have the humanism on both sides of the extreme spectrum. It really is that freedom middle ground where we can come together and argue and accept some of the compromises. That might not be ideal for me, but then I'm going to keep pushing, keep fighting to get to that ideal. Everyone's got their hands up, but I'm supposed to be closing in like 3 minutes here. So come up to me afterwards, we can talk about it. If you want to think more of the Ayn Rand and Karl Marx. But it really did surprise me. I just reread Ayn Rand, 2-3 months ago, after a big stint into communism, Trotsky, Lenin, and Marx. I was reading this, I was like, wait. So good, but where is she going with this? And then that piece clicked for me that she's humanist. She wants an elite aristocracy to own and rule the world. And that's my biggest beef with her. The rest of it I really actually kind of enjoy. Actually, same thing with Karl Marx, though. He was a smart guy. He had a lot right. Just, the wrong things were really wrong. Just really bad. Anyway, that's not what we're talking about here. Sorry, guys. The cycles. So look up the fourth turning. That gives a great example. So there's four turnings. And I'm just going to name them. You guys can go look them up. First turning. Let's start with the first. First turning is a spring. It's a rebirth. It's a regrowth. Second turning is the awakening. Things start shifting and changing. Rising generations want something a little bit different than their parents did. Third generation is the unraveling. Sorry, the first one I said the spring and not the actual title. It's the founding. One is founding. Two is awakening. Three is unraveling. And four is crisis. Right now, we're about in the middle to the tail end of the crisis period. Each of these lasts about 20 years approximately. So we're right at the end of a crisis period when everything breaks. World War II was the last one. Before that, it was the Civil War. Before that, it was the American Revolution. Before that, it was the Glorious Revolution. And you can keep going and going and going. That's a fourth turning. Our fourth turning is almost already over. Momentum and what's the time to prepare for it is past. We now get to live through it and experience it. COVID was a big piece of that, and it's not over yet. There are still more and bigger dominoes that are coming during this crisis period. We have anywhere from 2 to 10 more years of crisis. Buckle down, it's okay. Because after every fourth turning, after every crisis, after World War II, after the Civil War, after the American Revolution, guess what you get every single time? And that's what we're now living and preparing for. We have to live right now in the current times and deal with the current crisis we're in. But now what we're living for, what we're thinking about, what we're preparing, what we're teaching our children is a founding. So the crazy thing about a crisis that hasn't happened yet, but that's part of the process every single time, it's so strange, is that there's going to be a powerful unifier. There's going to be something that brings all these broken and dividing and divisive things and table those or get rid of those, and we're all going to get united again. So you're looking at it saying, how on earth can that happen? Again, you go back 100 years, and there was no way that the Republicans and Democrats were going to come together, and then World War II happened, and all of a sudden everybody was in line. Everybody was neighborly again. You go back again, Civil War, unfortunately that one was a fight over the division. So this pattern doesn't define what will happen or exactly when it will happen, it's just cycles. It's plus, and well, part of the Civil War was one of the 20-year periods, I think it was three. Part three of that turning didn't happen. We just skipped a whole 20-year part of the cycle. So yeah, it's not this is what will happen and this is when it will happen, because that doesn't work with human beings. We're fickle, if you will. Say that shortly. So we are coming into, in the next small handful of years, we're coming into a founding. We're coming into a time that we define and create the institutions and the culture as a society of who we will be for the next 100 years. That will govern us for the next 100 years. So the end of a fourth turning and the beginning of a first turning decide whether or not we have a force shift or a freedom shift. And we get to choose. Isn't that great? We get to choose. See, Ayn Rand and Karl Marx, my understanding of their philosophy is that that they get to choose. Those who are smart enough, have the higher intellect. Both of them say that verbatim. Those who have the intellect to understand get to rule and govern the masses. Those who have lower intellect. So they're the ones who get the power to choose. I argue, and I believe the Old Testament argues, that God is willing to teach us and to develop us to grow so that we all can choose for ourselves. And if that's the case, we don't get the high of the highs. You don't get a nanny state. If I choose for myself, you don't get a nanny state. It can't happen. Only if I give up my agency does that get to happen. For me, the Old Testament turned into such a great chronicle of the development of choice and freedom. It's hard. And there's struggles. We make mistakes, we break rules, we break commandments, and we have to suffer those consequences sometimes. And that's okay. Because in the long run, God knows exactly where we're going, and He knows exactly how to get us there, to develop us into perfect leaders, parents, fathers, mothers, sons and daughters. So even if we fail 100 years from now, we'll go through the cycle again. And God will say, maybe this time they'll choose it. And I say it's now. I challenge you. I invite you. I say it's now. That we learn to actually love our neighbor. How can you argue and disagree and still love them and know, have them know that you absolutely love them? How do you do that? Get a libertarian and a socialist in the same room together, have them argue and debate and love each other at the end of it. That's what we're after. For me, that's the Old Testament. These different groups and prophets and people who struggle and are different and argue, and yet God is there at every step of the way. Whether it's on this side or that side, he calls prophets from all walks of life, from all political standpoints, and says, if you'll follow me here in loving and leading the people, you will absolutely 100% win. I invite you to accept that call, to take that challenge, to be an optimist, because God's going to win anyways. I read the end of the book. He spoils the whole thing. Guys, we win. So just accept that. Just accept that and get to work. Just accept that and get the education that prepares you to actually win now, not 100 or 200 years from now. Now, we can actually win. Thank you guys very much.
Latter-day Saint Home Educators is a nonprofit, all-volunteer organization dedicated to providing inspiration to homeschool families. We hope you enjoyed this recording. If you are interested in listening to more recordings or would like to participate in a future conference, please visit our website at ldshe.org.